Good evening and welcome to Noir on the Radio. I'm Greg Barth, and tonight I'll be talking to crime fiction author William E. Wallace. You can join in the conversation as well by dialing 347-633-9609 at any time during the live show. That number again is 347-633-9609. Former San Francisco Chronicle reporter William E. Wallace's most recent book, Face Value, an Eddie Pack's novella, was released by Shotgun Honey Books in July 2016. His earlier books, Hangman's Dozen and Dead Heat with the Reaper, were published by All Due Respect Books in 2015 and 2016. His short stories have appeared in numerous magazines, including Out of the Gutter Online, Shotgun Honey, Near to the Knuckle, Beat to a Pulp, Plan B, and Spine Tingler. He blogs hardboiled crime fiction at pulphackconfessions.com. William E. Wallace, welcome to Noir on the Radio. It's a real pleasure and a huge honor having you on with me this evening.
Well, thank you very much, Greg. It's great to be here.
Great to get to talk to you finally. There may be some listeners out there who are unfamiliar with you and your work. Why don't you take a minute and bring everyone up to speed on, you know, you, your career, the things that make you the writer you are today?
Well, I've been actually a writer for more than pretty close to 40 years now, but I started out writing short stories, science fiction stories, and getting rejection slips. When I was a kid in high school, I was a big fan of Astounding, Amazing Stories, Fantastic, the magazine of fantasy and science fiction. So I was always very interested in writing. I served in the Navy, and I was a naval intelligence analyst for the Naval Security Group during the Vietnam War. And when I got out, I went to Cal and got an education, and then I worked at a variety of jobs, including one stint for about a year as a legal investigator for a law firm that did a lot of product liability, workers' compensation cases, slip and falls, and things of that nature in San Francisco. But I was always very interested in doing research, finding out more about stuff, getting underneath the surface of the topics that I was basically supposed to be doing some work with. And so I became a reporter because it was writing and it was investigating and research. And I spent 26 years at the San Francisco Chronicle doing that, won a bunch of awards for various different things, including four from the Society of Professional Journalists, for various different projects that I worked on that were basically like discovering corruption in various different municipal agencies, covering prison medical treatment issues, police brutality, in corruption in law enforcement agencies, and a lot of organized crime. And I decided that in 2006 I would take a buyout and try my hand at doing a little teaching. I taught at Hayward State University, California State University's Bay, for about 4 years. Then I did a couple of stints at a junior college and at Cal. And then I set to work really pursuing the writing thing again because I was retired and I was living on Social Security in my Taft-Hartley trust from the newspaper work, and I thought I'd see where I could go with it. And that's when I started doing short stories and sort of writing. I'd switched my interest during that time, though. I'd once been a real science fiction freak, but I felt like science had really moved beyond me. And you know, the stuff that was being written about by science fiction writers now was stuff that had to do with social issues and psychology and a lot of things like that that were of less interest to me than the stuff that I'd been interested in when I was a kid, which was space opera and time travel, you know, rockets and forearm men from Mars and so on. I switched over to crime, and I'd been doing a lot of reading through the years of people like Ross McDonald, John D. McDonald, George, Elmore Leonard, George V. Higgins, a lot of different writers, and I decided the niche I wanted to go for was one that was a little darker hit on crime, less about the puzzle than about the people who were doing the actual criminal activity. And I've sort of specialized in that since. So most of my stuff actually follows a sort of a formula that I first came upon when I was a teenager growing up in Colorado. And that's the EC Comics, Tales from the Crypt and so on, where every story was really a little morality tale. And no bad deed went unpunished by the end of it. So I tried to make my short stories that way, too. They're never the kind of justice meted out in these stories is that you would normally expect, you know, where somebody's arrested and put in, brought to the bar and then put in jail. They're always run into some sort of like, I guess, cosmic justice more than anything else. And that's sort of the formation of where I come from as a writer, the influences that sort of got me started down this road and that I've tried to follow as much as possible.
Wow, that's fascinating. I mean, you have a lot of rich experience to draw on. And I can see that, you know, the time spent at the San Francisco Chronicle would really prepare you to write crime fiction today, especially, you know, some of the, you know, the crime stories that you covered. Yeah, just an amazing story that you have to tell, William. Your latest work. Go ahead.
I was just going to say it's You do the best you can with what you got. This is the material that I have to work with, so it's going to have to do.
You know, I tried my hand at some science fiction and fantasy and westerns and you name it pretty much, and it wasn't until I just started writing about normal low-life, you know, folks and their struggles and their attempts to get ahead and make things right, I really wasn't able to complete anything. You know, they say, write what you know. I don't know that I know that, but, you know, you don't have to have a degree in astrophysics or live in the West to be able to write about those people. So that's why I chose crime fiction. So your latest work, Face Value, Eddie Pack's novella, was released through Shotgun Honey Books in July. How would you describe that novel to listeners who may not have had a chance to check it out yet?
Well, Eddie Pax is a character that appeared first in a couple of short stories that I had written. I think the very first Eddie Pax appearance is in a story that I did for Spine Tingler. And it was about a lawyer who comes on to a vast quantity of money by accident from a client who's mortally wounded during a holdup. And he doesn't know the source, but he doesn't care because he's going to take the money as soon as the client dies from his injuries. He's going to take the money and split. Eddie shows up at the very end of that because he has an organic relationship to the story. Eddie is a collections artist or a collections man, recovery agent, what we call a repo man. If you don't make the payments on your car, somebody comes around and they slim jim your door and get inside and usually have a set of dealer's keys that they can start the car with, and they drive it back to the original lending institution where they sell it for whatever the remaining blue book is. To settle a debt. Eddie, though, is a different type of repo man because he works for organized crime. He works for an outfit called the Combine that he describes as a startup for criminals. They provide money, front money, for large criminal enterprises, and they expect to get their original investment back plus pretty steep interest, as is the case with most organized crime lending practices. Anyhow, he shows up at the very end of this story called a Custodian. And I like the character, and I like the idea of playing with this whole thing about a repo man who wasn't really a repo man. He's really he's a thug, and he goes around. He gets what money back he can, but basically the idea is he cancels the account. And when he cancels the account, it stays canceled because he puts the people who were responsible for ripping off his company underground. And in face value, this not very nice person, Eddie Pax, is basically his company is ripped off during as a result of what appears to be a natural disaster, but when they investigate further, they find out that it was actually a setup during the big hurricane to flood the vault that a bunch of bearer bonds are being held in, which is one of the things that's sort of continuing type of currency used in organized crime. If you have them, anybody can cash them and can use the money from them. They don't have to be signed by a specific individual or anything like that. So $5 million worth of these bearer bonds are missing from this account in New York. And what Eddie does is he's put on the account, on the case, and he thinks, as it's described to him, as he's told about the circumstances, he says, well, look, if you know who the address is of the main guy, it sounds like anybody in the organization could do this job. Why are you picking me? And his boss, Frank Chance, says the reason is because the person that was the other party to this robbery is an old friend of yours from California, a fellow named Fitz Callahan, who Eddie knew from a job that went bad, and Callahan wounded him during the holdup that they were involved in, a jewelry robbery that they were involved in. And so he's got in business and pleasure in this one because he gets payback to the guy that had put him in the hospital back in California during this heist that went wrong. So basically, he's sort of got some elements of being a detective, but he's not a detective that goes around and knocks on doors and interviews people and stuff like that. He's a detective that goes around and knocks on people's heads until they tell him what he needs to know. And people who get in the way frequently find themselves pushing up daisies eventually. And that's sort of the nexus of the face value story. The face value in this refers specifically to the bearer bonds, which are worth the amount that's on the face of the bond. And it's a story where there's double crosses and triple crosses, and bodies stack up like cordwood. And it's a fairly violent yarn. There's not a lot of gore or anything like that, but definitely people buy the farm in it.
Yeah, Eddie Pax, he's like a Skip Tracer who has all the nasty tricks at his disposal, right? He takes it to a whole new low level. I was fascinated by the concept of the bearer bonds. I don't think I'd really encountered that anywhere before. But you say this is a fairly common currency for crime syndicates.
Exactly. The problem with bearer bonds is that they're usually very large denominations. And you're familiar with the currency transaction report. Anything up over $10,000 or over has to be reported to the FBI. And I actually, it's the FBI and the Treasury Department, I believe, both get information, and it ends up in the EPIC file and all this other stuff. So you've got to be careful with the way you handle them. And you've got to have that fence that can handle, either you get a percentage of the value of the bonds because the fence has taken the risk with cashing them, or else you come up with a fence who is connected with the bank and can do the work of that without raising, you know, causing any alarms to go off in Washington, D.C. And that's sort of the case, the latter is the case in face value, as it turns out.
Hence the title, Face Value. So I'm a big fan of opening lines, you know, especially when it comes to crime fiction. They can be so rich, and I'm thinking of things like Kane's line, "They threw me off the hay truck about noon, and the postman always rings twice," or, you know, some of the amazing first sentences that Richard Stark, Donald E. Westlake used in the Parker novels. And, you know, Stark is definitely a favorite of mine. But you have a really great opening line for Face Value, and I'll read it for the audience. It goes like this: "When police arrived at Oscar Johnson's apartment in Topeka, they found Johnson's corpse sprawled on his bed and Eddie Pack's in the living room 40 feet away." I mean, how can you read that and not finish the book, right? So as a writer, I'm very deliberate about my opening lines, and I'm curious, what were you going for and what were you thinking when you constructed that opening to Face Value? Because it really does pull you right in.
You know, I was the way I approach the job of writing, and I consider it a job, but it's also like, you know, solving puzzles too, because one thing leads to another. And what I like to do is set up a scene that kind of like drives the rest of the story. And I had originally done a version of this intro that really didn't quite reach it. And I sent a copy of the first couple of pages to James Keeley, who works for the LA Times out here in California, who's somebody I happen to know as a short story writer from Facebook, and said, "What do you think of this?" And he said, "You know, I got a kind of a problem with it because it doesn't really pull me into the story the way that I think that it should." And so I went back and I started puzzling over it, and I thought, I want to set up the scene, but what I want to do is I want to set it up so that it ends up being a turnaround in the first two paragraphs. So going on from what you read, I have the juxtaposition wasn't surprising. Pax had murdered a dozen people in 10 years collecting debts for the biggest crime syndicate in the U.S. What was a surprise in this case was the fact that Pax didn't kill Johnson. So I create the expectation in that first line, and then I explode it in the second line as the police are surging into the room. And the idea was there to try and find some way of turning around real quickly so that the reader would be intrigued by the situation. And first of all, it tells you a bunch of stuff about what's going on, because Pax is a murderer. Now, you know, he's killed a dozen people. He's not, you know, he has no qualms at doing it. But in this case, he wasn't the one that did it, but he's caught red-handed in the same room with the corpse. So I thought that that was probably a better way of sort of sucking people into the story and getting them started with it.
Interesting. Yeah, very well executed in that opening passage. Talking about Eddie Pax, you know, he's a tough guy, but he doesn't strike me as, you know, someone who's deliberately cruel or a mean person by nature. He's just someone who's willing to do whatever it takes to get the job done. He's not a very nice guy, though, when he's taking care of business and dealing with people he's after, those that get in his way. I don't want to spoil anything, but things don't go so well for the people that cross his path. But I get the sense that he would have been okay with those people if they weren't looking to pull one over on him. How would you describe Eddie in relation to his violence? You know, he's not emotionally charged. He's not the kind of person that goes out of his way for violence, but he uses it more as a tool to accomplish his job.
Well, I think that's really basically the point, is that Eddie is like most of the criminals that I write about in the longer pieces I've done. He's a criminal who is a lunch pail guy, as I call it. He's a blue collar worker. He's one of the grunts. He goes out and he does a day's work, you know, gets paid whatever he gets paid for it, has to worry about cutting the grass at home or, you know, making the mortgage payments and so on and so forth. And in this particular case, he uses whatever tools are available. It's like Mr. Natural says, you know, use the right tool for the job. And the right tool for his job in most cases is violence. But he doesn't take any particular pleasure in knocking the hell out of somebody or shooting them. It's just that, you know, this is the way you get the job done, so this is the way it has to be. I think that as I'm developing this character more, I'm actually working on another Eddie Pack story right now. That's an origin story about how he got involved with the Combine. That is going to lay out some of this philosophy or try to like weave it into the story. The main thing is I just don't want to tell people this is the kind of guy he is. It's like Jane Austen. She'd tell you more indirectly than she did directly. You know, she never would set out and write a passage that told you everything there was to know about a person. You know, don't load up the backstory in one little spot so that the reader starts, you know, having trouble swallowing. Do it. Weave it into the rest of it, into the comedy of manners and that type of thing. In a story, it's a crime story that's basically about a violent person that has a violent job, usually dealing with other violent people. I want to get as much action as possible in there and make the philosophizing just really a secondary element. So it's one of those things where you try to get this idea across, but without, you know, overselling the reader on it, because there's nothing worse than a talkie, you know, 20 pages of talkie stuff in a book that is supposed to be about things happening. That I don't think that ever really works very well. It certainly doesn't hold my attention very well.
No, I couldn't agree with you more. I think you can tell a lot about Eddie just by observing how he treats people in his different relationships with them. You've had a couple of other publications in recent months. There's the short story collection from All Due Respect book called Hangman's Dozen. And a pair of novellas under the title Dead Heat with the Reaper, also from All Due Respect Books. And, you know, it looks to me like we're in the midst of a golden age of novella-length crime fiction. Do you agree with that? And if so, why do you think that is? What makes the novella just right for this genre?
I couldn't agree more, first of all, because I think this is a perfect time to be writing these middle-length things. First of all, what is it we're told about all the time, or told all the time? People don't have time to read. Why are books not selling? People don't have time to read. Of course, books are selling. They're actually, sales are really kind of skyrocketing at this point. Otherwise, there wouldn't be so many big fights between Amazon and the big five publishing companies about, you know, e-books and things like that. But it's the e-books, I think, that have really made the difference in terms of novellas and short story collections. It used to be, when I was a kid, I'd get like dollar, there was something called the Dollar Mystery Guild. That was a book club that you joined, and every month they would offer a variety of different selections, one of which at least would be featured at a dollar, hardcover book with a fly leaf and the whole business for, you know, 100 cents. And it usually contained a lot of stories, and I really loved short stories. I loved being able to knock off, you know, a dozen stories in a night if I was really on a jag of reading. I always, when I get magazines, I'd get magazines that always, that was one of the things that they offered, was a variety of different lengths of stories. So I'd start with like fantasy and science fiction on a typical month. I would read Through Time and Space with Ferdinand Feghouth, the one that turned on a Shaggy Dog story about space travel or time travel or something like that, which always ended with this horrendous pun that was like, you know, made the stuff in Pearls Before Swine, the comic strip, look amateurish by comparison. I'd read that first because it was like one page, one and a half page. I'd read anything by Frederick Brown because it was usually one and a half pages. He always wrote these little short nuggets that were like really brilliant, but they were real short. Then I'd work my way up eventually to the novella length stuff, and I'd save for the last the serialized novels. Because, you know, they were going to take more of a time investment, and, you know, I wanted to get my full value out of each magazine. I've noticed with ebooks that there are a lot more collections now being put out. I mean, people solicit them. Chris and Mike, at all due respect, asked me to write a collection or put together a collection of short stories. So which ended up being Hangman's Dozen. These kinds of those anthologies have got a new lease on life. Now you have anthologies like that excellent thing, Unloaded, that Eric Buettner put together, that's got all those wonderful writers in it writing stories about crime that don't involve guns. You can do something like that, or you can do a themed antho that contains like all of these stories that are based on the songs of Bruce Springsteen, like Trouble in the Heartland, which Joe Clifford did for Out of the Gutter and Zelma Pulp. And those have come back. So it used to be they were just a very occasional thing. The big publishers hated publishing anthos because they didn't make any money. You know, you want somebody that has a continuing character, knocks them out in a hurry, and can write, like, you know, Lee Child or James Patterson, one of these guys that can just knock them out and, you know, do a book a year, two books a year. And Tom Clancy's another one. And they're big books, and you can sell them in a plane, airport or a train station or something like that for about $6 or $7. And, you know, you've made your money back and nothing flat. And, you know, you don't really have to spend much time promoting them because people are looking for things to read in those kinds of locales. Novellas had been something that had almost disappeared with the death of real pulp magazines. When it stopped being, it was distribution problems largely really killed the pulps, I think. The paper was just as cheap as it ever was. The ink was just as cheap as it ever was. But the problem was getting it to where it was the point of sale was really the big problem with pulp magazines. Those novellas used to be a sort of a primary thing in the pulps. And they just kind of disappeared. And now it's like ebooks make it possible to do something like that and sell it for $2.99 or $1.99 or, geez, down to 99 cents. I mean, some people give them away just to get, you know, the person into the tent. So that those have suddenly made a comeback. The one-shots from Shotgun Honey, the I think Snubnose does a lot of them. A lot of the All Due Respect catalog are novellas. And those are all terrific short reads. You can take them with you on a train in an e-book, a Kindle or a Nook or something like that. Read them. Read one on the way to work from, like, say, from Berkeley to San Francisco on BART while you're standing there in the train, and then put your Kindle in your pocket, go and do your job, and then read another one on the way home. And, you know, the novellas take a little longer than that, but they're still something that does not cause you to mortgage your life in order to really get into it. I think when I was a kid, to me, a novel, a long novel, was 120 pages. You know, and some of the stuff, like I was a big fan of A.E. Van Vogt, and his stuff was always longer than that. I mean, he'd write hundreds of thousands of words, but he was creating entire worlds and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And, you know, just they were more involved stories and they took more time to explain. A lot of this stuff people don't have time for. I think most novels nowadays are kind of like overwritten. I think a lot of the stuff that's out there has too much padding in it, so to speak. I mean, you know, Lee Child writes a great action story, but the problem is that probably 200 pages of that is technical junk. It's like coming right out of Popular Science or Guns and Ammo or something like that. You know, it's all this stuff about windage and elevation and muzzle velocity and, you know, the difference between 125 grains of powder and something else. That I think the story could lose that stuff, and it wouldn't be harmed at all. You just get to the, you know, it's like Raymond Chandler used to say, when you run out of ideas, have a man come through the door with a gun in his hand. It's a simple prospect. That's the idea behind most action-based stories. And I'd like to see more of that stuff, and you do in novellas. I mean, like, your trilogy is a great example. It's like slam, bam, thank you, ma'am. It's just one thing after another, and if you can put it down, you're a better person than I am, because I can't. When I get into something like that, I just got to read it right through.
Well, I do think that there is a case to be made that a lot of traditionally published books are bloated just to hit a word count expectation from the publishing house. And to me, I compare it to, I'd rather read Old Man and the Sea any day than read Moby Dick, right?
Yeah.
Hey, looks like we have a caller, William. So I'm gonna bring the caller on with us. Before I do, I just want to remind anyone else that wants to call in. The number to dial is 347-633-9609. And that Noir on the Radio is a trademarked, copyrighted podcast solely owned by the Authors on the Air Global Radio Network, LLC. So, caller from area code 260, you're on the line.
Hi, guys. This is Les Edgerton. Hi, Greg and William.
Hey, how you doing, Les?
Good.
Hey, Les.
I've been looking forward to this broadcast for a long time, and I was going to wait a while, but I thought I wanted to weigh in a little bit on the discussion here, if you don't mind.
Go right ahead.
Please
okay,
do.
I think William's right on the money, except there's basically why novellas became big again, why they were dying was because, like you said, the cost was too prohibitive for publishing houses to do it. E-books saved those, as they did short stories. You just could, In fact, my first collection was one of the last, I think, with a big five publisher. And at that time, you had to have a minimum of five stories already printed in reputable literary publications, big ones, before they even considered. There was only a handful that could get them published. Now, virtually anybody can because of the inexpense of it. And there's no longer that requirement that they be published in leading literary journals or any of that stuff. In fact, there's very few of those left, to be honest. But I was interested in your background, William, that you were in Navy and intelligence. I was a cryptographer at the same time, 61, 65 in the Navy. And you're a reporter. I went from that, after I got out of the joint, to being a reporter for the South Bend Tribune. But I wasn't a real reporter. I worked in the toy department to cover Notre Dame football. And then I taught in universities like you did, too. So we really have a lot in common, I think. But I really enjoy your work and everything. And I just wanted to weigh in on that a little bit. If you guys don't mind, I appreciate you letting me butt in. But I'm a big admirer of both of y'all.
Thank you. Thanks so much.
Well, thank you, Les. I'm glad you called. I'm a huge fan of yours as well. And we appreciate you calling in tonight.
Well, I'm looking for more work for y'all.
Okay, thank you.
And okay, we're looking forward to the next thing from Les Edgerton, too.
All right,
thank
see you.
You
in church, guys.
All right, bye-bye.
See you there.
Bye.
Yeah.
Man, that guy, Les Edgerton, I tell you, I was going to comment that, this show is called Noir on the Radio. And it's kind of a funny thing. I don't necessarily think of my own novels as noir by the strictest definition. And I would say while there are noir elements in your book, your works, William, there's a bit more hope. Yeah, hard-boiled, I think so. But Les Edgerton, he wrote one of the best noir novels I've ever read called The Bitch. And if anybody out there hasn't read The Bitch yet, you should check that out. But yeah, I agree. I think that, that your stories are, they're not all out tragedies like most noir tells. Hard boiled, I think, is a good description.
Yeah, well, I'm stressing the violent nature of the criminal enterprise. I'm working on a book right now that is kind of like all over the map because it's called Bottom Street, and it's based on a fictitious street in San Francisco's Tenderloin, which is basically a headquarters for a lot of the criminal activity in Northern California. And there are people there that are pimps. There are people there that are the long con, the big con type confidence men. There are, people that are drug dealers and so on and so forth, crooked cops. One cop is in love with a transgendered woman that's pre-op, and he's like constantly, it's a big scandal within the police department. The mayor is a bozo, and he keeps doing the same thing over and over again to try and lighten up the situation with crime in the Tenderloin. But it doesn't have a high degree of violence like Face Value does. It's like all over the map because there are various different types of scams that are played and so on and so forth. It's going to end up with a sort of a dust up that involves two major characters, but other than that, it's like mostly it's more like Damon Runyon than it is like Raymond Chandler. More what a bunch of maroons. These guys are really pretty funny in a way. They're bozos, but they are actually kind of humorous. And then I'm writing one that's that Eddie Pax fits into, and it has. It involves industrial safety, believe it or not. This is going to sound really weird, but there's a way that he's trying to collect money that's owed to the combine by a construction company in California that's got a history. And he actually enlists somebody as an ally in his campaign to recover the money and to take out the people who cheated the combine. And that one's called Graveyard Shift, and it's totally bizarre, because what suggested the story to me was somebody put a video up of one of these big industrial shredders that would eat a concrete block with rebar and stuff in it. And I suddenly thought, you know, that'd be a hell of a way of getting rid of bodies. You know, just turn them into little bits of meat hash that could then be buried at a construction site. And so it's kind of like all over the map too. But the main thing is that they're hard boiled, because they've all got that sort of violent edge. And if there's not violence going on, there's the threat of it immediately in the background. So I'm more comfortable with that, writing an action-related story than I am anything else. And I know what you mean about the more hopeful stories, I guess, Legacy and the Creep, the two that are in Dead Heat with the Reaper. Those stories are a little bit more hopeful, a little bit less hard-edged, not as dark. But you know, in one of them, a guy has already murdered two people. This old guy has already murdered two people, and then he ends up doing a third one in the course of the story, and always for the best of reasons. But you know, he's a one-man wave of destruction when it comes to, you know, evening up those scales on the balances of justice. And in The Goon, there's only one death, but there's two deaths, but only one of them is a bad guy. And he takes a colossal, reaches a colossal end. But the story is basically about somebody who's so hideous to look at because of the scars he received in Afghanistan that everybody thinks of him as a monster. And he's really not a monster. He's just another poor, broken soul that's, you know, trying hard to get by in the world.
Yeah, Dead Heat with the Reaper. Amazing couple of novellas in that one, and they go to some dark places, but they don't end as bad as you might expect they could. Let's talk a little bit about the writing process. You know, how would you describe your approach to writing? Are you one of those guys who you write every day? Do you make outlines? You know, those kinds of things.
Well, I've been since I got sick, I've been doing a lot more erratic kind of writing. I spend an awful lot of time sitting around playing my guitar now. But I like to actually sit down and write a lot of stuff out longhand. And then when I start transcribing it into the computer, I start messing around with it. I move things around. I start, you know, sharpening up some passages. I try and find better ways. I see that there's a potential for making some sort of a point here, so I try to sharpen that. I'm not a plotter. I'm not somebody who writes outlines, and I don't come up with a, you know, dramatis personae list of characters, although I've done that a couple of times. Basically what I like to do is I like to set out a scene, and then I like to put the characters in it, and I like to have them take me wherever they're going to take me. And I like to let the story happens to me. It's like, you know, it's almost like automatic writing in a way. I wish I could say it was as easy as automatic writing, but I just like to let the story run free. And then if I run into problems with things that don't work, I take them out, and I start rearranging them. That's when the work part comes in. But basically, I like to work from specific scenes. I like to try and visualize what's going on as clearly as possible in the opening sequence, and then have it go from there and just see where it takes me. It's probably not the best way or the most efficient way to write, but it's one that works for me.
And that's the one you need, right? Who would you list, William, as your major influences on you as a writer?
It's funny. Everybody's been, you know, bombing each other with these, tagging these, each other with these lists of writers that were influential. And I wrote down a bunch of people that, you know, came to my mind right away the time that I got tagged. And I suddenly realized I was leaving some people off that were really important. And actually, one of the ones that that got me really started was, believe it or not, this is going to sound funny, Phyllis R. Fenner, who wrote a book called Dragons and Witch, Giants and Witches and a Dragon or Two. And I read it when I was in the fifth grade, and then I read it again, and I read it again and again and again. And I think I must have had that book out of the school library in Rifle, Colorado for about maybe 3 months. And just reading it and rereading story after story about these various different witches and giants and stuff like that. And it really stuck with me because when I wrote a piece for Craig Neely and his wife had this wonderful magazine called Dark Corners. When I wrote this piece called Witch's Hat Trick, which is an oddball one-off for me. It was a crime story about Russian organized crime figures, but the actual protagonist in the story is a witch. He's a Russian sorcerer. Or a Ukrainian sorcerer, and it gave me a chance to use some of my old Russian and stuff like that, you know, for various different figures of speech and stuff like that. But I found myself using the same basic description of the famous Russian witch Baba Yaga in that story that Phyllis Fenner did in Giants and Witches and a Dragon or Two. She lived in a house that walked around the yard on chicken's legs, and she had, when she would pound on her, she rode in a mortar, and she'd pound the side with a pestle, and when she gnashed her iron teeth, it sounded like pokers falling over in a fireplace. All of those things, I used them in describing the boss of this Russian gang as one of his crime partners saw him, and he always reminded him of Baba Yaga, the witch, and so the fake witch was up against the real witch in this case, and it's a story that that I had forgotten until just the other day how much that book by Fenner had influenced me. But I'd say, of the crime writers, I read a lot of Rex Stout, and that's one of the reasons, another reason why I've got a big sort of Jones for writing novellas, because Rex Stout was a master of the novella form. A lot of those Merrill Wolf stories are actually novellas. In fact, most of the ones that have been made into movies were based on novellas rather than the longer novels. He was good with characters. He told a lot. He made the person that did the deductions, the person who did the actual ratiocination of solving the crime, was this eccentric genius, but the legwork was all done by a guy that was like every man, you know, Archie Goodwin, like every person that you've ever known. He was kind of a sort of semi-hip guy, Weisenheimer, always trying to keep up with the boss and thinking on occasion that he was, and then always being sort of flabbergasted afterwards that, you know, Nero had come up with this totally different construction of everything. when it came to realistic crime writing, I think George Higgins and Elmore Leonard, they were two of the more influential ones to me. One of my favorite books of all times was Get Shorty, and they actually made a terrific movie out of it by sticking pretty much to the dialogue from the book. The characters are just like brilliantly drawn in that. And I loved, that was another one where the good guy is not really a good guy. He's a leg breaker for the mafia in Florida, Chili Palmer. And he's a person that uses violence, and he uses it as a tool. It's not anything that he takes any particular pleasure in, but he's always, he knows exactly how to be tough in a way that is convincing to people that he's tough without him having to do something like, you know, break their nose or something like that, although he does that in the book. anyhow, I always thought that. My dad was a tough guy. My dad was a guy that would get into bar fights and stuff like that. He'd win. And but he was never a guy that telegraphed what he was going to do. I mean, he didn't stand there and jawbone for 25 minutes before he'd haul off and knock somebody off the bar stool. He'd just do it. And I think that's the way real tough guys operate. They don't stand around and quip like, Philip Marlowe. They pop somebody in the chin. Or actually, my dad once described watching one of my uncles drive a guy to the ground like a pile driver. And that showed up in Face Value, that same basic scene where he kept hitting the guy so many times he just drove him to the floor. He couldn't fall fast enough. That was one of the things I liked about Elmore Leonard. The other thing about Elmore Leonard was that the criminals were always half smart, and the cops were always just a little bit smarter. And I mean, that's a perfect pairing, because cops are not like CSI or NCIS or any of that junk. I mean, most cops are ham and eggers. They are just doing a job and doing the best they can with it. And they muddle from one thing to another. And I've never really known any police detectives who were brilliant investigators. You know, a lot of times they're just lucky, that's all. And they manage to solve a crime. The best is when you walk into the scene and there's the guy standing there with the meat hammer in his hand and the dead body on the floor and blood all over the place, and he confesses. Slam dunk. You don't have to be Sherlock Holmes and check for the ash types and compare it with 47 different types of tobacco ashes and all that other sort of stuff. I kind of laugh at the stuff in CSI, because I've seen police labs and they're really slovenly pigsties for the most part. You know, they're not like these hermetically sealed places where, you got some guy that comes in and can, you know, blood type somebody from a drop of blood in the mosquito's beak or something like that. It's a lot clumsier than that. Remember the FBI? I mean, they were the great experts on fingerprints, and it turned out that their fingerprint stuff was all screwed up. And everybody sent their stuff to the FBI for analysis for DNA and stuff like that. And it turned out that lab was run like some sort of a pigsty too. These are supposed to be the top cops in the country. So I like that part of it too, that the cops were only slightly smarter than the criminals. And sometimes the criminals were smarter than the cops, but the cops were luckier than the criminals. And I like that part of it. Parker, Richard Stark and his Parker character were probably one of the most influential, long-term influential characters on me, because he was a professional thief who only did one thing. He engaged in heists, and he was very good at it, but he had terrible taste in partners because they always ended up screwing him, and then he would spend the rest of the novel trying to get his money out of them. And I like that, too, because it was more of that description of the criminal as a lunch pail kind of guy, a blue-collar worker who does a job. And he's another one that doesn't take any particular pleasure in shooting somebody, but he just does it because it's like, you know, he's a force of nature. You've got to get from A to B, and if somebody is in the path, you put a bullet in them, or you beat the hell out of them, or you throw them out of a window. And I always like that because, you know, to me, crime has always been capitalism without any of the good manners at all. It's always been just raw. You know, if Jean-Pierre Proudhon was right and property is theft, then the criminal is the most bare-faced type of theft there is. And most of them don't make a lot of money at it, which is kind of ironic, too. But, I mean, you know, you don't see master criminals like in James Bond or something like that. They're always kind of like pluggers, including the bosses. Yeah. I mean, remember Vincent the Chin Chiganti wandering around his neighborhood in New York. Everybody thought he was crazy because he's always out in his bathrobe and slippers. But he was running the mob from his bathrobe and slippers. You know, it's like a kid living in his basement and he's controlling the internet, you know, even though he doesn't have a job. He has to borrow coffee money from his mother. I just love that kind of a contradiction to it. I mean, you know, the world's a funny place, and I like to see the humor in it. And sometimes the humor is pretty dark, but that's okay. I don't mind that.
Wow, that's a rich list of influences. Man, we could talk about those guys, you know, for days. Where can people keep up with you out there on the web, William? What's the best way for folks to kind of stay in touch with what you're doing and what you have up and coming in the days to come?
Well, I have to say I'm on Facebook. And I'm on Twitter, but I'm on Facebook a heck of a lot more than I'm on Twitter because I've had pretty good luck writing flash fiction, but I can't quite master the 140-character limit in doing a tweet. I like to say a little bit more than 140 characters worth really will contain. So I'm there, and then I've got a blog that unfortunately I am running hot and cold on these days because I've got so much stuff to review that I'm backed up on that it's hard for me to, every time I look at it, I think, oh, God, you got to write that review and this, that. I mean, I owe about five right now of books that I've actually finished completely reading, and I haven't gotten around to writing any reviews of them yet. So, you know, I'm running hot and cold there. It's not like I post every Saturday or anything like that, but it's www.pulphackconfessions.com. And it's just a blog about, it's mostly about crime fiction, and it tends to run to a lot of the people that are published by indies, and a lot of the people that that I know of from having had some contact with them through social media, because that's what I like to read. And there's a lot of it out there right now, probably more than there's ever been since the last black mask went off the presses back in the 40s.
Yeah.
That's where you can find me when I blog. I usually tweet and I usually Facebook a notice that there's something new on the blog. So you kind of got to keep all your bases covered with me.
Well, it's a great blog. You know, I watch for those reviews to come out, and I check out every one. And you know, you've certainly been so gracious to me. I really appreciate the the kind reviews that you've taken the time to write, and so many other writers out there I know feel the feel the same. You really take a thoughtful approach to your subject. So thank you for that. And
wow, we made it
to the top of the hour. Yeah, we made it to the top of the hour pretty fast. I feel like we could go on, but William, thank you for joining us, joining me on Noir on the Radio. It's been great having you on the show, and I'd love to get you back on again, sometime soon.
Okay, I'd love
to
do
the listeners. Absolutely, maybe we can talk about George V. Higgins and Richard Stark and all these guys, and kind of go into some depth. There's a lot of rich stuff there. And to the listeners, check out William E. Wallace's books, Face Value from Shotgun Honey Books, Hangman's Dozen, Dead Heat with the Reaper, both from All Due Respect Books. They're just a mouse click away. And this is Greg Barth. Until next time.